Well, ladies, let's turn to 1 Samuel, shall we? 1 Samuel. We'll start in chapter 14, I think, and work our way by. If you wouldn't mind closing that door, someone. Thank you. We're in a series that I've entitled, Like David, We Want to Be Women After God's Own Heart, looking at several of the incidences in Samuel's life. And this one this week has to do with friendships. You know, I read a ditty one time, which I crack up every time I reread it. It says, one of my goals in life is to wind up with eight people who are willing to carry one of my handles. Coffin, you know, eight handles. If you think about that in a culture like the Christian culture, it seems a little strange because, gee, every Sunday we stand around and talk to people. We have a group of women here in Bible study. We meet once a week. We talk afterwards. We have gals that we meet with and pray with. We have moms that are of a similar time in life with kids, and we go to the park, or we hang out at a soccer game, or a thousand other things that I see us all doing on Facebook. It's a little hard in our culture to think about not having relationships. But I want to challenge you today, when you listen to this message, I want you to ask yourself, not just who do I hang out with, who can I have a cup of coffee with, but who really gives a rip about my life? I have several criteria for friendship, even in my own heart. And the truth of the matter is, as I looked at this lesson, it made me stop and think how much time or energy I'm using to cherish some of those very precious gifts that you and I kind of gloss over. So I hope in today's lesson that you'll care more about than just the eight people that'll carry your coffin, that you'll see the levels of friendships that David had, and maybe you'll spend a little time this week enriching not only your own relationships of people giving to you, but you'll look around your world and go, oh, I could be that to her. I could be that to them. And see if there isn't some application. So the first one about David's kinds of friendships is found the story starts in 1 Samuel 14. It's the relationship that he has with Jonathan. And then this relationship has been maligned much in current day. Jonathan and David had an incredibly close relationship. To call them best friends underestimates the power that God had given them in their relationship. Partially, we underestimate it because we don't get into Jonathan's life. And I don't have time today to develop Jonathan for you. But those of you that know the stories well of David and Jonathan, I urge you, get your Bible out this afternoon and just study Jonathan. I'm going to give you one little glimpse at him, because we kind of gloss over him and we figure, okay, there's David, we know a lot about him, and they were good friends, and oh, that's wonderful. And David says at one time, my relationship with you is sweeter than that of women. And then immediately the crowd begins to wonder if that's some sort of a hanky-panky homosexual relationship. It clearly is not. But we're focusing on the David side. Think about Jonathan just for a second. In 1 Samuel 14, there's some Philistines doing their nasty stuff to the Jews again, or the Israelites. And Jonathan, in verse number 1, the son of Saul, Saul's the king, says to his armor bearer, come on, let's go over to the Philistine outpost on the other side. But he didn't tell his dad. Saul was staying on the outskirts of Gibeah, excuse me, under a pomegranate tree in Migron. With him were about 600 men, among whom he's got some buddies. And it says on verse 4, on each side of the pass where they were, that Jonathan intended to cross to reach the Philistine, there was a cliff. And so there's a cliff on one side and a cliff on the other side. Sorry about the cough. That's kind of rude. Anyway, Jonathan in verse 6 says, come on, let's go over to the other side, the outpost of those uncircumcised men. Perhaps the Lord will work on our behalf. Nothing can hinder the Lord from saving, whether by many or by few. And so his armor bearer says, okay, let's go. And he says, I'm with you in heart and in soul. Verse 8, he said, come on then, we'll cross over and let them see us. And if they say to us, wait here till we come, we'll stay there where we are and not go up to them. But if they say, come on up to us, we'll climb up, because that will be our sign that the Lord has given them into our hands. So both of them showed themselves to the Philistine outpost. Look, said the Philistines, the Hebrews are crawling out of the holes they were hiding in. And the men of the outpost shouted to Jonathan and his armor bearer, come on up to us and we'll teach you a lesson. So Jonathan said to his armor bearer, come up after me. The Lord has given them into the hand of Israel. Now, pause just a second. He didn't tell his dad he was going. The army is not supporting him. This is just him and his armor bearer. So Jonathan, in verse 13, climbs up using his hands and feet, his armor bearer right behind him. Philistines fell before Jonathan. Why? I don't know, but they did. His armor bearer followed. He killed and killed behind him. In that first attack, Jonathan and his armor bearer killed some 20 men in the area of about a half an acre. Okay, verse 15. Panic struck the whole army. Those in the camp and in the field and those in the outpost, and the ground shook. It was a panic sent by God. So great moment of bravery, personal bravery, absolutely. God supported it, created some additional frustration, challenge, scare tactics, etc., by shaking the ground. It says in verse 16 that Saul's outlooks, he's checking out. He saw the army melting away in all directions, and he says to his men, muster the forces, thank you, sweetie, and see who has left us. When they did that, it was Jonathan and his armor bearer who were not there. So he goes, okay, now I know who's doing this. Bring the Ark of God. At that time, it was with the Israelites. Saul, talking to his priest, he says, withdraw your hand. Then Saul and all his men assembled. They went to battle. They found the Philistines in total confusion, striking each other with their swords. Those Hebrews who had previously been with the Philistines and those who had gone with them to their camp, they went over to the other side. When all the Israelites were hidden in that hill country, were on the run, or heard that the Philistines were on the run, they joined the battle in hot pursuit. So on that day, the Lord saved Israel, and the battle moved on. So the story has to do with Jonathan's bravery, not even involving his father or the army. That's great. But the next part is kind of interesting. It says the Israelites were in distress that day because Saul had bound the people under an oath, saying, cursed be anyone who eats food before evening comes, before I have avenged myself on my enemies. So none of the troops tasted food. He, out of the blue, says, okay, we're not eating, we're all fasting until I have a chance to get out there and get after the enemy. You know, Jonathan's done a very brave thing, but nobody's eating, everybody cool it, etc. Well, Jonathan doesn't hear about that. And in verse 26, it says, when they went into the woods, they saw that honey oozing out. Nobody put their hand to their mouth because they feared the oath. But Jonathan had not heard that his father had bound the people with the oath. So he reached out his hand at the end of the staff that was in his hand, dipped it into the honeycomb, raised it to his hands, and his eyes brightened. Meaning, he got some carbs in him. You know, he got some sugar. He's been fighting all day long. He's got nothing in his system. So he gets a handful of raw honey, which would light us all up. And he's in good shape now. Then one of the soldiers said, whoa, you're in trouble. Your father bound the army under a strict oath, saying, cursed be anyone who eats food today. That's why the men are so faint. Jonathan said, my father has made trouble for the country. See how my eyes brightened when I tasted a little of this honey. How much better it would have been if the guys had eaten. And the story goes on. I only tell you this story because I want you to see that it's not all David in this friendship. Jonathan is a man with an independent spirit. You'd have to say David was. These are two independent-minded men who are willing to do what's right in the eyes of God, regardless of what anyone else has to say, including Jonathan's father. So what is this friendship like? Go to chapter 18. I'm just wetting your whistle on Jonathan there. The story really is about David, but I wanted you to see that this was a friendship of strengths. You know, sometimes we think that friendships are because one person's very strong and the other person not so. That's usually not true. The really amazing, great friendships are because two different people bring lots of strengths to the table. They may not be the same strengths, but they are strong personalities, strong people. In this case, in chapter 18, we continue to see the relationship between Jonathan and David develop. Saul hates David. He feels jealous. He knows that he's the coming one. He, in some cases, his hatred falls out before he's anointed, David, that is. In other cases, it falls out after he's been anointed. But I want you to see in chapter 18, it says in verse 18, chapter 18, verse 1, after David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. From that day, Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his family. Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic, even his sword, his bow, and his belt. Here's the point. Jonathan is sacrificing something significant here, which is lost on us. When he gave him his tunic, his sword, his bow, his belt, he in essence says, everything I own, my privileged position as son of the king, I now give to you. So let's think about the most important things you cherish. Children, and a few possessions, maybe your home. In the friendship that's being described for us in this intimate way, Jonathan's willing to give it all to his friend. That's a pretty amazing statement about this friendship. Go to chapter 19. Saul's going to try to kill David off on a number of occasions. And in chapter 19, let me start with the first verse. Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan had taken a great liking to David and warned him, my father, Saul, is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I'll go out and I'll stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and will tell you what I find out. So Jonathan spoke well of David to Saul, his father, said, let not the king do wrong to his servant David. He has not wronged you, and what he has done has benefited you greatly. He took his life in his hands when he killed the Philistine. The Lord won a great battle or a victory for all of Israel, and you saw it and were glad. Why then would you do wrong to an innocent man like David by killing him for no reason? So Saul listened to Jonathan and took his oath, as surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death. Well, Jonathan calls David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. So during this moment, during this time, he is a loyal defender before his father of his friend David. Defending a friend is not always easy. If they're in the right, it's easy. It's not so easy when they've done wrong. And I don't mean defend like act like they're right when they're wrong, but to stand with them. In this particular case, David's done nothing. And Jonathan is exercising his loyalty of defending David. But sometimes it's not so easy. Now look in chapter 20, down about verse 40 or so. Maybe verse 34 is a good place to start. Jonathan got up from the table in fierce anger, because Saul is... slung his spear at David, missed him, didn't kill him, but anyway. So Jonathan's ticked. And on the second day of the feast, he did not eat because he was grieved at his father's shameful treatment of David. In the morning, Jonathan went out to the field for his meeting with David. He had a small boy with him, and he said to the boy, run and find the arrows that I shoot. As the boy ran, he shot an arrow behind him or beyond him. When the boy came to the place where Jonathan's arrow had fallen, Jonathan called out after him, isn't the arrow beyond you? Then he shouted, hurry, go quickly, don't stop. The boy picked up the arrow and returned to his master. The boy knew nothing about all of this, only Jonathan and David knew. So this was a communication skill that he was giving some information to Jonathan about whether or not it would be okay to stick around or whether his father was going to kill him. And the placement of the arrows were telling a story. And when he says, hurry, go quickly, don't stop, he's not telling the boy to go get the arrows. He's telling David, get out of Dodge. He is willing to do some things here. If you drop down to verse 41, you're going to see David or Jonathan willing to give David the freedom to be himself. After the boy had gone, David got up from the south side of the stone, and he bowed down before Jonathan three times, and with his face to the ground, and they kissed each other and wept, but David wept the most. Wait a minute here. You know, Jonathan is trying to support his friend, but he's giving his buddy in an opportunity to express his deepest emotions. And his deepest emotions right now are that he loves and cares for Jonathan. And so Jonathan lets him express it. Sometimes we cut off intimacy between friendships, and that would also between you be you and your husbands. We cut it off because, oh no, you shouldn't, it's okay. Sometimes the expression of the deepness of the hurt or the happiness or the joy or the sadness of the moment needs to be expressed. And Jonathan was smart enough to shut up and let David express what was on his heart. And David wept the most. And then if you go to chapter 23, and there are tons more illustrations in these 10 or so chapters. That's the one we showed. 23, yeah. Chapter 23, verse about 15 or so. And here you're going to see some unceasing encouragement. Saul's told that David's, hidden out somewhere. Verse 14, David stayed in the wilderness strongholds in the hills of the desert of Ziph. Day after day, Saul searched for him, but God did not give David into his hands. While David was at Horesh in the desert of Ziph, he learned that Saul had come out to take his life, and Saul's son, Jonathan, went to David at Horesh and helped him find strength in God. Don't be afraid. My father will not lay a hand on you. You will be king over Israel, and I will be second to you. Even my father Saul knows this. And the two of them made a covenant before the Lord. Then Jonathan went home, but David remained in Horesh. That is my favorite illustration of their relationship because of how Jonathan encourages David. Notice back up in verse 16. And Saul's son Jonathan went to David at Horesh and encouraged him. No. What does it say? And helped him find strength in God. Not strength in himself, not in a platitude, not in a Hallmark card, not in a sweet gesture, not in something that was written on Facebook or on a phone conversation, but he drew his friend to the feet of Jesus. Here's where you're going to get some strength, buddy. Not in me, not in our relationship, not in the words that I can say. The way I can best help you is get you to the feet of the cross. And there, you can find some strength. Now, this is an amazing friendship. It defies even current cultural understanding of the word friendship. A couple of words about this love that David and Jonathan have. The word is habib in Hebrew, and it is not the word that is used for intimate or physical love, like the between husbands and wives or lovers. It is not the word that normally is translated to know, which in the Old Testament, if you know anything about the King James Version, every time it said, and they knew him, it doesn't mean to have sex. It does, however, imply some political overtones. It's more than just a physical affection or a natural affection. It's a deep and genuine one. It's something that is unique and special, and it is not tainted by just being expressed in a physical way. It is heart to heart. It's the connection between souls that occurs between intimate friendships. And again, I would say to all of you that are married, that starts with your husband. That starts with having that kind of connection with him. And many of our marriages suffer because those kinds of relationships are not sought after. They're not nourished. They're not encouraged. The time and the energy and the sharing and the caring and the peeling away of the layers of who I am and who you are, getting to the gut of your life and the other partner doing the same, it's not invested in. Instead, we have coffee with friends. Nothing wrong with having coffee with friends. I'm just saying, start with the relationship that God made primary in your life and then move to perhaps another relationship. If you die and have a friendship like this, you are blessed. I mean blessed. And if it happens to be in addition to your married relationship, oh my gosh, two of them? You're like God's favorite. At a critical moment in David's life, when Saul is out to kill him, the Bible literally says, when it gives the idea of their covenant, their spirit was bound with spirit. There was a connection that nothing could break. You know, David at this point in his life needs an intimate, caring friend whose heart beat in sync with his. Nothing surface about it at all. Again, if that's lacking in your marriage, start there. If that's good in your marriage, foster it, nourish it, feed it, give it time, give it attention. And then if God, by some act of incredible grace, gives you another intimate friendship like that, just fall on your face and thank him. That's the first one. That's the first relationship, the first friendship in David's life. There are a whole host of others. I want to give you two other levels of the kinds of friendships that David had. The second one is what I'm going to call encouraging friendships. Now, you got to know a little bit about David's life here, and I hope you're reading through 1 Samuel, kind of following along on the storyline a little bit. But in 1 Samuel, you're going to hear the beginning of the story, and then it moves into 2 Samuel. And of course, you know you can go to Chronicles as well, because Chronicles is a second historical account, only written exclusively from the perspective of the two tribes in the south. So it's kind of a repeat. So if you're reading through your Bible and you hit 1 and 2 Samuel and you hit 1 and 2 Chronicles, you go, didn't I just read that? Yeah, you did in part. And sometimes in Chronicles it will emphasize it even more. But if you're going through the story of David, we're getting to a place in 2 Samuel where David has been fleeing from Saul. That's all over. All of that stuff that made him what we might call a broken man, moving to the fact that he's going to have the affair with Bathsheba and the child will die, again, a broken man. And then he's arranged for the murder of her husband. The guilt of that is somewhat overwhelming. He's got children who are doing really bad things, including some incest, rape, and murder. And then his son, Absalom, breaks out in abject rebellion against his father to become king. Now that's an awful lot of brokenness. What kinds of friendships does God send in times of brokenness? Well, he's fleeing from his own son. He's afraid in 2 Samuel, turn there, 2 Samuel 15, that his own son's going to catch up with him and kill him and take over his throne. And again, he's still suffering from the devastation of the ramifications of his sin. And he's going to have three guys that are showing up during this time that have a slightly different but very important way of encouraging David. I want you to see all three of these guys in the context of Absalom is doing his conspiracy, trying to kill his father. David needs to get out of Dodge. He needs to get out of Jerusalem. He needs to hightail it, because if he doesn't, Absalom's going to kill him. So in 2 Samuel, let's pick up the story in about verse 13. So a messenger came, and he told David, "The hearts of the people of Israel are with Absalom." Oh, great. On top of everything else, the people have turned against me. Then David said to all of his officials who were with him in Jerusalem, "Come, we must flee, or none of us will escape from Absalom. We must leave immediately, or he will move quickly to overtake us and bring ruin upon us and put the city to the sword." The king's officials answered him, "Your servants are ready to do whatever our lord the king chooses." The king set out, with his entire household following him, but he left 10 concubines to take care of the palace. So the king set out with all the people following him. They halted at the edge of the city. All his men marched past him, along with the Kerethites and the Pelethites, and all the 600 Gittites who had accompanied him from Gath marched before the king. The king said to Ittai, the Gittite, "Why should you come along with us? You go back and you stay with King Absalom. You're a foreigner, an exile from your homeland." Now pause. Okay, so he says, "We got to get out of Dodge. We got to go now. You guys stay with the palace. Keep things running. I'm going to take some men. We're going to get out of town." He's marching out of Jerusalem, stops on the other side of one of the hills, says, okay, now let's see, you guys are going to go on, you're going to go on, nobody's seeing you, okay, we're all safe. And so the people, known as the Gittites, who had come from where Goliath had come from. So when they conquered the Philistines from that area of Gath, where the Philistine warrior of Goliath had been slain, one of the officials that had now come into his army, his inner core, if you will, is a man by the name of Ittah. And Ittah says, wait a minute, you want us to run? You want us to go? Whatever, whatever you want us to do, we're going to do it. And David says, wait a minute, I want you, Ittah, to go back and I want you to stay with King Absalom. You're a foreigner. You're an exile from your homeland. You came only yesterday. And today, shall I make you wander about with us? When I don't know where I'm going, I want you to go back, take your people with you. May the Lord show you kindness and faithfulness. But Ittah replied to the king, as surely as the Lord lives and as my lord the king lives, wherever my lord the king may be, whether it means life or death, there will your servant be. And David responds to him and says, go ahead, march on. So Ittah, he says, I'm going to stand with you. I don't care whether I live or whether I die. I am here with you. Me, my family, the army, portion of the army that I command, we're with you. So that's one person's response in this crisis. Okay, so look at verse 23. So the whole countryside is weeping aloud as the people are passing by. They see their king, you know, running into hiding. The king also crossed the Kidron Valley, and all the people moved on towards the wilderness. Zadok, here's another guy, was there too, and all the Levites who were with him were carrying the Ark of the Covenant of God. Now these are the guys who were entrusted with caring for everything that happened in the temple. And so they're carrying the Ark, and they set the Ark down. And Abathar, he offered sacrifices until all the people had finished leaving the city. When the king said to Zadok, take the Ark of God back into the city. If I find favor in the Lord's eyes, he will bring me back and let me see it and his dwelling place again. But if he says, I'm not pleased with you, then I'm ready. Let him do to me whatever seems good to him. The king said to Zadok the priest, do you understand? Go back to the city with my blessing. Take your son and Abathar's son, and you and Abathar return with your two sons. I will wait at the forge in the wilderness until word comes from you to inform me. And so Zadok and Abathar took the Ark of God back to Jerusalem and stayed there. All right, similar situation. He's a high trusted official in his entourage. He happens to be a Levite. His job is to carry the Ark or some of the implements to the Ark. David knew that the Ark belonged to Jerusalem, not with him. And so he says to Zadok, I want you to go back. You are needed there. And he agrees and says, okay, whatever you want, we'll go back. Now we got two guys, and there's a third one coming in a second. The first one says, I'll stand with you. I'll be with you. Life or death, I'm here. And David goes, great, come on and travel with me. The second guy essentially gives the same message, but David goes, no, this isn't good. You're part of the responsibility of the Ark. You need to take the Ark back in Jerusalem. The Ark belongs there. You go back. And the guy goes, okay, whatever you want. So third guy, about verse 30 or so. So David continues up the Mount of Olives, weeping as he went. His head was covered. He was barefoot. All the people with him covered their heads too and were weeping as they went up. Now David had been told that Ahithophel is among the conspirators with Absalom. So David prayed, Lord, turn Ahithophel's counsel into foolishness. When David arrived at the summit, when people used to worship God, Hushai, the Archite, was there to meet him, his robe torn and dust on his head, a sign of great mourning. And David said to him, if you go with me, you will be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, your majesty, I will be your servant. I was your father's servant in the past, but now I will be your servant. Then you can help me by frustrating Ahithophel's advice. Won't the priests Zadok and Abathar be there with you? Tell them anything you hear in the king's palace. Their two sons are with them as well. Send them to me with anything you hear. So Hushai, David's confidant, arrived at Jerusalem as Absalom was entering the city. Third guy, in equal reverence and equal compassion for his dear friend David, he's he's displaying his brokenness about what's happening to David by the grief, tearing his coat, putting ashes on his head. He's screaming out, this is wrong. You shouldn't be treated this way. You're not supposed to be fleeing. This is your kingship. This is your palace. This is where you should be. My heart is broken. I care about what you're going through. And although David is deeply moved by his friend's compassion, he says, you know what? You can serve me better by going back into town and working with my son and giving me a report from now and then. The point is, at a very devastating moment in David's life, he needed encouragement, and it came in different forms. You and I need friends who are not identical. They're not the same. Sometimes in our situations, whether they be very, very bad or mildly bad, whether there's a brokenness associated with us or a painfulness or a family thing, a relationship thing, a financial thing, whatever it might be, when God sends encouraging friendships, they are not all the same. They don't act the same. Don't feel like you have to respond to a friend's need exactly how she does or they do. It's different. Each one of us have different gifts. We have spiritual gifts. We respond to things differently. In crisis, some people respond differently than others. I have a friend who, in crisis, the only thing she knows to do is to cook, basically to bake. Man, you want that woman on your short list if you're going through something. The bacon stuff that's going to show up at your house. That's just her expression. If you look at Ittai and Zadok and Hushai, all deeply committed to David, all wanting to be a part of his entourage, all wanting to be with him and serve him, but he sends them out to serve him in slightly different ways. You and I need to both be and have different kinds of encouragers in our lives. And then lastly, David has what I'm going to call sustaining friendships. Go to 2 Samuel 23. He's got an intimate friendship, he's got encouragers, and then he's got sustainers. We're at the end of David's life. And he is going to hear, and in 1 Chronicles 11, in essence, write his last song. He brings out and lists for us what our Bible talks in the margin there, David's mighty warriors. See about verse number 8? He talks about the top three of his warriors. These are the names of David's mighty warriors. Joseph, Bathsheba, was a chief of the three. He raised his spear against 800 men whom he killed in one encounter. So he's a warrior, and he's standing with David, and he's one of the top three. Next to him was Eleazar. As one of the three mighty warriors, he was with David when they taunted the Philistines that were gathered for battle. Then the Israelites retreated, but Eleazar stood his ground, struck down the Philistines till his hand grew tired, froze to the sword. The Lord brought about a great victory that day. The troops returned to Eleazar, but only to strip the dead. So there's the second of the mighty three. And in verse 11, next to him was Shema. When the Philistines banded together at a place where there was a field full of lentils, Israel's troops fled from them. But Shema took a stand in the middle of the field. He defeated it and struck the Philistines down, and the Lord brought about a great victory. It says, during harvest time, three of the 30 chief warriors came down to David at the camp of Abdullam, while a band of Philistines were encamped in the valley of Rephath. When the time came, David was in the stronghold, and the Philistine garrison was at Bethlehem. And David longed for water, and he said, oh, that someone would get me a drink of water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem. So the three mighty warriors broke through the Philistine lines, drew water from the well near the gate of Bethlehem, and carried it back to David. What did he do, guzzle it down? Read the next part. He wouldn't drink it. It was too precious. It was too sweet, too incredibly wonderful that it would happen, that those guys would bring him that water simply because he was musing about, oh, wouldn't it be great to have some water from my favorite old well in Bethlehem? And when they got it for him at great personal cost, he wouldn't drink it. He poured it out as a as an offering to the Lord. You talk about sustaining men or friendships. Between that story, verse 18, it goes on to talk about the commanders that were part of his mighty men. And when you drop down to verse 24, he starts calling them out by name. You know, he lists 32 mighty men of his army, of his entourage. Now, he had thousands at his beck and call. And at the end of his life, he calls out three special ones and tells a story, then talks about three commanders, and then lists the 32 men that he calls his dearest friends. At the end of his life, he is rehearsing in his mind the incredible deeds that were done to sustain him and his kingdom and his friends who were there, even when he didn't ask. He just was musing, oh, wouldn't it be great to have some of that water? And they jumped to it. Those kinds of friends who don't have to be asked, you know, who just show up, who just do, especially things you would never ask for. I told you before that friend, when I had one of my knee surgeries, who walked in the front door, they left the front door every day because people were bringing meals and just spoiling me, you know, disgustingly. But, you know, many people had said, can we come over? Can we clean the house? No, I'm fine, fine, fine. Besides Barb's here, no. I was waving off everybody, wave off. Well, one day the front door opened and I thought somebody was just bringing food in. I said, hello, and they didn't answer me. And a few seconds later, I heard the vacuum cleaner turn on. Well, now I'm screaming. I can't get out of bed, so I'm screaming, oh, Dada, what is that? And you hear it coming up the steps. Thump, 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 thump. Some bad guy's in vacuuming my house. He's coming up to get me. Got to the top of the stairs, and there was my friend Loretta. What are you doing? I'm hollering over the vacuum. She just gives me the, you know, shut up, wave off. Goes down the hallway, back to the rest of the house, walks in, gives me a kiss on my forehead and says, see ya, and walked downstairs and left. If she'd opened the door and said, Cherry, can I vacuum? What would I have said? Go away. No. House is fine, leave it alone. These sustaining friends, they didn't even need a request. All they got was a musing. Wouldn't it be great to have some water? It's kind of like the lady here at Stony Brook that heard me say something about my love for Cadbury's. Mm-hmm. And at Christmas, I got a bag. And I couldn't figure out what the deal was because everything in the bag was a product of Cadbury's, mm-hmm. including some of my very favorite. And they were all from Great Britain. They were not the United States version. So I went to the lady after Christmas vacation. I opened it up over Christmas vacation and ate the whole thing, I'm telling you right now. But I said to the lady, how did you get all that good stuff? Oh, my husband. He was in England, and I heard from my daughter, okay, a kid, I don't know, sometime I said something a little musing about the chocolate from England, and lo and behold, I get a bag. Okay, well, I thank her profusely. I write her a nice note and whatever. I pass her the other day. She goes, oh, my husband goes back and forth to England all the time. We'll keep it coming. Like, I really need that. Amusing. A little, ooh, wouldn't it be nice to have some Cadbury from England? And lo and behold, these are sustaining friendships. Now, what's the so what? Okay, so we've looked at David. He's got an intimate friendship. He's got guys who are willing to encourage him no matter how the encouragement would come. And then guys who are there to just sustain him through his whole reign. What does that mean to us? This is a series where we're trying to figure out how to become the kind of women of God so that he might say about us, you know, the things that he said about David, a woman after my own heart. I want to give you three, I hope, are practical things about deepening your own friendships. The first one is so obvious, you've heard it a billion times, but you have to make friendships a priority. It just takes, it takes time and attention and effort to have a meaningful relationship. I am by nature a reclusive monk. What's the female version of monk? Monkess. I'm a female monkess. I am happiest with a book and a cup of coffee and my chair on my patio and 3 hours left alone. And then a good ball game thereafter. And maybe a little fishing after that. I am not by nature a social creature. Now my buddy Dennis, oh my gosh, he's energized by people. He plugs in and gets the juice of life by being around people. I get the juice of life by unplugging. Does that mean that neither of us should make friendships a priority? No, he should in the ways that match his personality and the way God's wired him. And I should that match my personality and the way I'm wired. It still takes priority. It still takes time. It still takes energy. It's stuff. It's intentional. Proverbs 17 says, a man loves at all times, or a friend loves at all times, and a brother is born for adversity. It takes effort to have a meaningful relationship. It takes more than a cup of, Starbucks. It does. It takes time for someone to have some confidence that you're not going to yabber everything that you just said. It takes time for there to be a peel back of a layer, a bit of honesty, a bit of I'm not nearly what I look like. And you don't know that I was raped when I was 12 and it has profoundly affected me. Okay, that does not come out at the first cup of Starbucks. It takes energy and time and intentionality. It means a little less ball game, a little less quiet reading on my deck. Oh, but how powerful. And to not have it. So the first thought I give you about deepening friendships is make it a priority. And the second one comes out of that, and that's to cultivate transparency. Learning to express yourself, your needs, your deepest thoughts. Proverbs 18 says, a man of many companions will come to ruin, but there is a friend who sticks closer than a brother. Funny, I was on the phone with my father last week after Dennis announced that he was retiring this year, and I was telling my dad that. And there was a real pause on the other end of the phone. I said, oh, Sherry, that makes me very, very sad. I said, I know, Dad, and I launched into this, but we got to have the best for Dennis and Edie's grandkids. And he goes, no. I know that he's closer to you than your two brothers, and I've always trusted that he would care for you. I'm sad he won't be there. That's my dad. See, cultivating transparency, you have to express your feelings. You have to express. You have to say it. You got to write it. You got to call him. You got to put it on a card and put it on a piece of paper and email them and put it on Facebook and, I don't know, the thousands of ways that you say you matter to me. I don't know really anything about Colleen and her brother, but just looking at the pictures that you posted, I'm going to say there was something special about that weekend to sharing that with your brother and the pride that you had. I looked at those pictures 4 or 5 times yesterday, watching his family honor him for his investment in our country as a warrior, but his sister, So we say it by showing up, we say it by being there, we say it 1,000 ways, but you have to cultivate transparency. Now, on the other hand, I had a friend for a while, I avoided him like the plague, because every time they were with them, I was with them, inappropriately, out would come transparency. So like the second time I ever met this woman, and we were indeed having a cup of coffee, she laid on me all this stuff about her family relationships and there was incest and all this stuff. And we're sitting in Starbucks and she's talking very loud. Second cup of coffee. So, you know, there's a time and a place. But transparency is part of that. That, you know, expressing. Look at 2 Samuel 1 just for a second on this note. 2 Samuel 1, verse 26. Really, start with verse 23. This is at the it's David's lament that Jonathan is, well, Saul's died too, but Jonathan in particular. He says, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and admired. In death, they were not parted. Okay, father and son, they were swifter than eagles, stronger than lions. Then he talks a little bit about daughters of Israel weeping for Saul. Look at verse 25. Pardon me, how the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. He is not talking about a homosexual relationship there. He is saying there's something more than sex. He's saying that there is a connectivity that happens when there is cultivation of transparency. There is a connection that can happen that has nothing to do with the routine relationships of husband and wife and so on. So if you're going to have deeper friendships, they have to be a priority. You have to cultivate transparency, which takes time and effort. And then I wanted to put down that real love is something that we do, not just feel. It's one thing to have precious, encouraging relationships. It's another to let them know. It is important to be a communicator of care. It's not enough just to care. If you're praying for someone, tell them. Write them. Give them a note. Yes, you pray for them. That's a right and appropriate and godly thing to do. But you can exponentially make it better by letting them know you are. By sharing, and especially telling them exactly what you're praying for. I'm praying this for you. It's not just I pray for you. Pray for you. Great, thanks. But when you write me a note and say, Sherry, this is what I prayed for you Tuesday afternoon. Oh, I saved that one. Sometimes it's a touch. I was in a meeting not too long ago, and it was my job to hold my emotions in, and I was doing a really good job of it. And the person sitting next to me reached over and put their hand on my shoulder.
Oh, yeah.
What a jerk.
You're done once your life's
it was done. It's all over.
So true.
Do not touch me. Right?
It's very true.
Sometimes it's, you know, a small and, you know, but meaningful gift. I'm just saying love is more than just an expression. It's an expression given. It's shown. Some of us are communicators, and so notes and that sort of thing come easier. For others, not so much. I am a prolific writer. I'm a communicator. I am. I've told you the story that when Brianna was moving, not this last time to go to Texas, but the time before that, and she was in the back of the truck and throwing stuff in, and something was said about the stuff that was getting in the truck, and a cardboard box fell out, and on the ground were all these cards. And she ran over and went, "Oh no, let me get those." And she's getting these cards off the ground. And she put them all back in the box. And she turned to me and she said, "This is my most prized possession in life." No, that's not Brianna. And I looked at the box and said, "What's in the box?" She said, "Every note you have written to me." Whoa. Whoa. I'm a writer. Some of you, maybe that's not your gift. So call them. Record a message and give it to them. You can do that on your iPhone now. you know, maybe it's something. Maybe it's a Cadbury's with a post-it note on it that I had somebody that was going to England get this for you. Wow, that is so powerful. So you thought about me, you thought about something that really mattered to me, not just a dumb candy bar, but the candy bar. Ask a friend who was going to England to bring it back and then got it to me. If we want rich relationships, then it involves some doing too. So I put at the end, don't just seek out those that can care for you, but look around and ask yourself the question, who needs you? Where is someone in your life that needs you? Right now. Maybe in this room, maybe in your neighborhood, maybe in your church, maybe in your family. Somebody needs you. What do you got to do to help them, to encourage them, to support them? Because at the end of the day, guys, they're going to take our bodies and they're going to put it in a box and they're going to drop it in the ground. And you want somebody that cares to carry it. You want somebody to be able to get up and say something about you that isn't, as Dennis usually says, ding dong, the witch is dead. That's what he says he's going to say at my funeral. Love it. It's not going to say that. David had levels of friendships, and he had a rich life, and it's there for us, and it's tremendous examples. Levels, the intimate ones, the encouraging ones, and the sustaining ones. I just hope that you'll listen to the Lord this week. Reach out to somebody. Don't just be looking for the ones that are yours. But there are some folks around you that need you. Let's pray. Lord Jesus, there is so much in David's life that's rich as an illustration or an example. And he is a flawed man. He's not perfect, but you called him a man after your own heart. And you gave him relationships that were unique and meaningful and at different levels for different reasons at different times. I pray, Father, that we would think about that. Thank you sincerely for those that are deep and rich. And then, Lord, to be aware of others around us that might need us this week, next week. Help us to extend ourselves. We do want to be women after your heart. We pray it in Christ's name. Amen.